Blog Talk Radio.
Well, you may throw your rock, hide your hand, working in the dark against your fellow man. But as sure as God made black and white, what's done in the dark will be brought to the light. You can run on for a long time, run on for a long time, run on for a long time. Sooner or later, gotta cut you down. Sooner or later, gotta cut you down. Go tell that long-tongued liar. Go and tell that midnight rider. Tell the rambler, the gambler, the backbiter. Tell him that God's gonna cut you down. Tell him that God's gonna cut you down. Tell him that God's gonna cut you down.
Welcome to Walls in Our Minds. This is Terry Dodd, and my co-host Red Beckman should be joining us shortly, and hopefully Doug Millar will be calling in here shortly and getting us hooked up with a simulcast for Crusade Radio and Where Angels Fear to Tread. I'm going to open us, as we always do, with a brief prayer to get this started out right tonight. Please pray with me. Almighty Father in heaven, we just are so thankful for the ways that you are blessing us. We see all of the evil that's around us, yet you do find ways to make good come out of that evil. And we're so blessed to know that at the end of this road, in this mortal road on this earth, that we have eternity with you, and that you're going to be the final victor here. We know who wins this battle. We know we're in a spiritual battle, and we invite you to join us and to include us and to use us in that battle. And we just pray that you will multiply our efforts. We pray that everything we do and say will glorify you. May your spirit be with us during this show tonight, especially with our guest. In the name of your son, Yahshua HaMashiach, we pray. Amen. Well, Patrick McMillan, our mystery guest. We put out a promo, Patrick. Let me introduce you to our listeners and give you the floor for a minute and let you kind of give them the two-minute bio. We're going to be talking about a lot of things that have happened in your life and experience tonight, so I don't think we want to get too deep into it to start, but if you could just give our listeners a brief bio on yourself, I sure would appreciate it.
Well, sure. I think probably more importantly, they'd like to know what they're going to hear about in the show, and a brief bio is a little bit difficult. So I'll just start out by telling you, I'm the only person I know of to successfully beat off a BLM assault. And I did it by proving they do not own any land in any state, save the forts, dockyards, magazines, arsenals, and other needful buildings, as set forth and described in Article 1, Section 8, Clause 17. And my win was never made public. So I'm going to tell the story now for the first time publicly on this show. If you record it, preserve it, and pass it on, I think great good can come out of it, particularly for anyone currently being attacked by the Bureau of Larceny and Mismanagement. But I want you to have a clear understanding of it chronologically, so I'm starting at the beginning. It may seem boring at first, but you'll see how it all ties in as you go back and review the tape. And this tape will be a roadmap for any brave pro se litigant to win any case involving BLM or any other alphabet agency that exists solely because they're funded, if they come before an honest judge. That's the hooker. And a good attorney could crucify them with this information, but it would cost him his ability to practice law in the future, because a king without clothes needs no tailors. So that will be my story.
That's quite a story. I know that you wanted to start out talking about the myth of federal jurisdiction tonight. We've spent a little bit of time talking about jurisdiction here at Walls in Our Minds, and I believe that our listeners are probably a little more educated than you might expect, and we've certainly got a group of folks that that are in tune with this topic, and we've had Clive and Bundy on here for a whole show a couple months ago, back right after his standoff down there. So this is a hot topic, and we'd love to hear what you've got to say on this myth of federal jurisdiction within the states.
Okay. Well, in order to understand that, I really need to start at the beginning. I have prepared some notes. Can I stick with those? It'd be easier for me.
You certainly may. Right before you get started here, area code 970, is that you, Linda?
That's me. Hello there.
Patrick, I'd like to introduce you to Linda Beslin, who is very... Patrick, do you know Linda? Are you familiar with her?
I may. If I do, it was from 20 years ago. Were you around this stuff 20 years ago?
I was. I was, Pat. But you, we were on the phone together the other day with Doug Millar.
Oh, yes, yes. I had such a bad connection, I didn't recognize your voice.
I know. It was a bit difficult. But, yes, it's good to talk to you again.
Good.
Welcome back to Walls in Our Minds, Linda. We're going to give Patrick the floor here, and he's going to stick to his notes, he says. We're going to start out talking about the myth of federal jurisdiction.
Yeah, I'm kind of old, so if I don't stick with my notes, I'll get lost, and we'll miss the important things. So I don't want to miss the important things. Are you ready?
Go right ahead.
Okay. Yes. I've always had a sixth sense when it comes to recognizing a crime in progress. I was actually, and I should start out by saying, all of the stuff I'm going to tell you, someday I'm going to put in a book that's going to be my kid's legacy. So everything's copyrighted. Somebody's going to want to make a movie out of some of these things, I know, but I'm still protecting my copyright. So I was actually the youngest FBI walk-in they ever had. From age 18, I began stumbling onto some substantial crimes in progress. And initially, the feds were skeptical when I handed them a well-evidenced case, but eventually I was better received, particularly because I wasn't a paid investigator, and I had nothing to gain other than the satisfaction of taking dangerous criminals off of the street. And then in my 20s, I was recruited by Lieutenant Colonel Carl Eifler, known to every intelligence agency in the world as the deadliest colonel. In fact, there's a book by that name by Tom Moon, if you want to get it. I think you'll find it interesting. It's not great prose, but the information is unbelievable. Carl was sent by Roosevelt into Burma in January of 42 to set up something called Detachment 101, which later became the OSS, and which, of course, is today's CIA. And he was the country's most accomplished hero, war hero, any kind of hero, of the 20th century. At that time, Carl was running an off-shelf op, reporting directly to Dick Stilwell, who was the Supreme Allied Commander of NATO. And Carl was suffering from his war wounds and was running out of steam, so he groomed me to replace him. I had no idea what was happening to me at the time, but I was very quickly being thrust into a life of high adventure. And as a side note, that's how they got me. They pandered to your addiction. Mine was adventure in the stealth mode. I was hooked. I was placed into some long-term deep cover assignments early on with the ABSCAM team, with some really great guys I worked with there, and then into some more serious stuff. Before I knew it, I looked up and I was a secret agent. And while working long and deep inside a Sopranos operation, I made a discovery that led to identifying the Soprano, Rudolf Toski, an alleged bon vivant European Formula One race driver, millionaire, and all-around rake. And he happened to be the most wanted Nazi war criminal of World War II. Hermann Goering had orchestrated the theft of all of France's art and loaded it into 17 trains, each around 100 boxcars, and sent it north to Berlin. But none of the trains, cars, art, or personnel was ever heard of again. All of it just disappeared. The only evidence was one little pinky print that was preserved. And I was able to snatch a razor blade that Toski had used for chopping cocaine, and it had his fingerprint on it. When the feds ran the print, I expected he would have been busted, but he wasn't. And I didn't understand why at the time, but years later it fell into place. He was being protected by high people in the government. He had bought protection from a very high level, and he was untouchable here. And I had just arranged a meeting between him and a hitman, so he could have him take out his partner, and he had given him $5,000 for the hit, and through a series of unexplainable events involving phone calls from the local bureau on FTS numbers, Toski was alerted I had set him up. So he sent a hitman for me, and I had to shoot, and he had offered that guy $5,000. I learned the next day he raised the price to $100,000. A month later, it was raised to $5 million. By that time, of course, I was long gone. I'd packed up my family and left town, and I needed a place to be off the grid so I couldn't be tracked. That ended up being out in the desert of Nevada where I could mine and process silver ore to feed my family. My closest neighbor, 5 miles, was also working a mine and was a cousin of Senator Harry Reid. We became good friends, and also with Harry's uncle Jeff and his wife Mary. Jeff was one of those salt-of-the-earth kinds of guys, a man of his word no matter what, and really a truly great friend. In our conversation one day, before I had any knowledge of Nevada politics, Jeff warned me about his nephew. If he ever gets wind that you're working a mine and making money in Nevada, he will find a way to extort or steal it from you. It's just Harry's way. He can't stand to see anyone be successful who doesn't owe him for that success. And Jeff was right. I also spent a lot of time with Warren Dewing, who owned the town of Searchlight, where Harry grew up. We both had an infatuation with cutting horses. And my wife was his grandchildren's tutor. And since it was Warren who caught Harry stealing from him at age 13 and offered to make him into a super criminal, a politician, if he would learn how to behave and pick his crimes, Warren knew more dark secrets about Harry than anyone alive. So after Harry had betrayed Warren, in fear of retaliation, he had his minions shadowing Warren to see who he was spending his time with and unloading to about the betrayal. In 1992, he approached a lawyer I use and also did some investigations for and bribed him and his wife, Gordon and Evan Hyde, to set me up on the task of telling him all I knew about Harry's dark past, allegedly to be used to unseat him. Not only did I tell him what Warren and Cousin Johnny had told me, I went digging and found a whole lot more, like his grammar school records where he was constantly getting in trouble for events in the boys' room, and the fact that he waited until Aunt Mary was in intensive care and sent her a letter stating that he had tied up all of the land around her house, locked up all her ingress and egress, and he would give her $50,000 for the property, take it or leave it, for a property that he knew was worth a whole lot more than that. It was the mine that had supported Jeff and his family for their whole lives. But the clincher was when the Clark County Superintendent of Schools found out that half of the 15 students in Searchlight Elementary, first to fifth grade, were being sexually molested at home. One of those was Harry's brother's daughter, a second grader. The super contacted Harry, who quickly notified the parents of the other children involved to get their families out of town. His brother was a county road repair worker, so Harry got him a job up north on another county crew, taking the seven-year-old with him. Seven children could have been rescued but for that political motivation. Harry chose to cover it up and further the misery of his niece and the other six kids. I've always wondered what she would say if anyone ever asked her about her childhood. So not only did the Hydes steal the $10,000 I had lent them when the IRS seized their assets, they served me up to Harry, who rewarded them by making Gordon his campaign finance manager. You know, I had mistakenly thought I had finally met an attorney who was honest when I started doing business with Gordon. And, of course, you know, that can't be possible. Now it's important to understand how Harry has set up about stealing the thousands of acres of land that he has stolen and arranged into the hands of Sopranos Gary Getz and Guy Inzalco. My dear and departed friend and co-BLM Reid victim, Wayne Hage, did an excellent job of showing the historical nexus of the Reid land thefts in his history of the storm over the rangelands. Everyone's focus here should be on the methods the BLM uses to brainwash the masses to turn a deaf ear to the uproar, such as the main battle cry, "He won't pay his lawful grazing fees to the people." The key here is that they never use the word lawful, because if that was ever dissected, as Wayne did in the storm, it becomes clear that there is no lawful base for those fees, as I'll paraphrase Storm and explain. But the focus here is that once the false assertion is unmasked, the BLM loses all ground to demand any money. NRS 1.030 holds that except where it conflicts with the U.S. or Nevada constitutions, The law of Nevada shall be the same as the common law of England. That means land ownership here is by the same laws in England. Land rights are gained in England either by barter with a demonstrated current rights holder, or one who, or someone goes to an area of the countryside never before claimed, and he marks it out and sets up housekeeping, a business, etc. If the claimant is on the property at least 6 months and 1 day for five consecutive years, he is recognized to have earned allodial title. Just like any king, he can give off fee title to anyone he chooses, and they then have feudal title. They still don't own it. The king does. Or here in this country, who owns it, actually they rent it to us by the tax, is the government. They do it on a preferential basis as long as it's good for them to do so. So now you're primed to understand the way the lies were built. We just have to go back to the beginning and see how the fees originated. The family that electrified Europe and sucked up all of its coinage was Enrico Fermi's. Enrico invented the dynamo and he electrified Europe. Once he owned Europe, he set his sights on North America. But since he couldn't be in two places at once, he needed a surrogate. But how to find a man you could trust with the cash he would carry to build the railroads, the national parks, fund GE, Bell, Edison, huge cattle and farming enterprises, ad infinitum, without him stealing it from you? That was difficult, but he finally found a supremely polished con man awaiting execution, and he bribed him out of prison, groomed him, and gave him daily reminders that if he ever crossed him, he would have him killed, evading pursuit. Fermi gave him trunkloads of cash, a disguise, and a new name, and sent him to make that new name famous. That name was J.P. Morgan. When you see old cowboy movies where the big ranchers from the East were damming up the water to push out the small independents trying to feed their families, it was J.P. Morgan and his thugs doing it. In an elaborate plan, Fermi brought in outlaws to rustle the ranchers' cattle, even killing them when they wouldn't give in and move on. The ranchers that resisted petitioned the army for help, and the army sent a few soldiers to be visible, like that Walmart security guy in the parking lot where the light just flashes so everybody knows where he's at. More complaint brought more troops. Initially, each rancher would house one or two men and feed them, but eventually barracks were built and money was needed to feed and house them so that the army wouldn't have to house them themselves. The ranchers agreed to pay their overhead and were assessed based on their size of their herd solely to house soldiers for the purpose of protecting their cattle. And that's how it worked for a long time. During that time, a few generations passed and the ranchers always made their protection payments, even after the frontier saw its last cattle rustling. It was just something Dad always did, paying grazing fees, so the kids just went on blindly paying the fees, never really realizing the service they were supposed to be paying for was no longer being performed. It was just habit. Eventually, there was no longer a need for that office to provide protection. But have you ever heard of a federal agency obsoleting itself? Not a chance.
No.
No one will halt cash that's flowing. Just divert it to another cubbyhole. Along that evolution of the rights collection of the protection money, were handed off to agencies that issued permits. So they just treated it and referred to it like it was another permit fee, when in fact it was an extortive fee being claimed by the government for many decades after they stopped providing the service. The collection of those fees since the cessation of standing that protection force and agreement amounts to fraud and extortion by an agency of the government. No one's ever accused them of that. They just let that slip by. Any person involved in trying to collect or enforce those fees, badge or not, is involved in an extortion conspiracy. The truth you will understand later is that no federal agency ever had the authority to grant any homestead or mining rights. They were able to do it because they had the most guns and the people weren't willing to fight them over land alone. And Harry's a brilliant crook. He figured out in the 60s that there was a lot of privately owned land that he could steal by way of this multi-generational disconnect. By around 1850, all of the grazing and farmland in Las Vegas Valley and surrounds had been claimed and worked, and allodial title was theirs in perpetuity. All of it was owned. As economics changed and the farm boys went to the city, the folks died off without the kids taking over these non-productive ranches. They were still the legal heirs to the land ownership, even if they forgot. So Harry wanted to use government gauze in front of the camera to disguise the theft of the land he funneled to Inzalco and Getz, that they sold all of the big developers who built out Las Vegas to the rim of the valley and beyond. The only fear standing between Harry and stealing the public land was the fear that one day a long-lost relative would come forward and demand reparation of his great-grandparents' land that might include most of those developed lands. So in anticipation, he came up with a scheme to make it appear that he had preserved their heritage. He created the concept that before public land was sold to developers, it was traded internally in the government for a plot of equal value land somewhere else surrounded by public land. That way, if ever such a lost heir is found, he would tell them, "Not to worry, we've preserved your wealth by exchanging your property for one of equal value. It's just outside the city a few or maybe 100 miles." Then he established a procedure for ensuring the fair exchange. Remember, most BLM thugs have interned in Harry's office, so they were all his people. He owns the BLM's heart and mind. So the BLM, Harry, sends out a team to evaluate the worthless played-out mine in the middle of nowhere and works up a report of value. The lead person fills out a cover letter verifying the attached report is the truth, and he signs it. Another group is sent to evaluate the area between, say, Sahara and Charleston, signs his verification letter. These two sets of documents are then received by the local BLM head, and the verifications are removed and reattached to completely false reports that make the plots appear to be of equal value. Now, give me a break. The land where a shopping center is built is equal to the same acreage taken up by a played-out gypsum mine. But in Harry's mind, at least, it's plausible. A point to defend from. Excuse his overzealousness. Now, we see he's taught that to Big O, Big Zero. He's using that all the time. You know, just make up a story that kind of sounds plausible, even though it hasn't got a chance of flying. So you can see I knew way too much for Harry's good. He had already done the turtle thing, and Clive and Bundy was the last cattleman left in the state out of, I think, 50 to start with. I was the last small miner. They had regulated all of the others into poverty. But since I had no employees and I was actually making money from the dirt and not from fleecing investors, I wasn't an easy target for him. Since I had been attacked by the BLM, I was checking out their other forays and was at the Bundy Ranch on the day in 93 when mounted BLM Rangers rode up to the closed gate of the ranch, and BLM Ranger Berger, can't think of his first name now, who usually ran the assault teams against me, told then 17-year-old Russ to open that gate or I'll shoot you. No one ever did anything about that. He threatened that 17-year-old kid. He should have been arrested and tried for that. The BLM visited my mine 9 times in the first 30 days of their siege on me. One of the times they came with 24 vehicles, each with 4 armed men, who got out and immediately removed their holster safeties and did their usual testosterone swagger before engaging me. Little did Harry know that I have friends in low places, including the BLM office in Las Vegas. So each time they had a secret meeting to plan a surprise raid on me, I'd get an advance warning. So I called out my retired CIA, DIA, NSA, and Pentagon friends, and they came with their cameras and recorders. If they'd ever failed to be there when the BLM came, I would have been killed. And they'll all tell you that's the truth. They were out for blood. One of the BLM secret internal DEA agents, Castro Giovanni, admitted to me later that when he realized he'd been lied to and set up to try and goad me into a gun battle so they could shoot me resisting arrest. All federal agencies have their own secret internal DEA agent, C-Unit, because Janet Reno made them all self-funding. That is, they get no money from Treasury, but in exchange they keep everything they seize with no accounting of money, property, drugs, anything. His interest in being there was to see if he could trump up the first meth lab bust the feds were going to make, and he was really disappointed when he found there was no meth lab as promised, nor was there any way that he could make it look like there was. And each time they came out with some state or county agency to try to get them to charge me with some violation they would make up. And one of those times, they claimed that a dam I had built to collect water from a spring was damming up the waterways of a navigable river because when it was raining, there was a flash flood, someone could canoe down that wash. At this point, an observer who had come out, Walt Lombardi, stepped forward and said, "Hold it. I'm from the state water, and the government has sent me out here to see what you boys are doing, and you can't do it. He's completely legal. Leave him alone." But that didn't stop them. They kept coming. I kept driving them off with my knowledge of the law, so they increased the intimidation, even taking my sidearm for no reason, saying, "When cops are around, only cops will have guns." One of those times was videotaped and played every night on Channel 3 as the lead-in story for 6 nights in a row. There were 6 armed men in a semicircle, sun on their backs, facing me, each with a semi-automatic 10mm. Facing them, sun in my eyes, I could sense what was up. One of the Metro thugs, Dave Patterson, moved to my side to get within range of my single-action 44. There's a sense that comes about you when you know that you have to be drawing and shooting to save your life. Time nearly stops in your mind, giving you time to add up all of the tells you've observed from each combatant, and you quickly sort out priority objective number one. There has to be an action leader. No one wants to draw first, so all but the initiator will be slower. You identify the one who you think will be first, then you place the others in their listed probability. At that moment, I had no fear. I had years of training and practice with my piece, and I knew at that distance I would take the first 3 movers in under a second and a half. The others would have had turned and run by that time unless they were already on the ground missing their pants. My training told me that my stance had to change if I was going to be able to hit number 3. Also, I had a poor view of my number 2. He could have moved just slightly, and I would not have been able to see him draw. So I immediately shifted my weight and swiveled to the left so I could fan number 3 if he decided to draw 2, and I also had a full view of number 2 and his gun hand. I had never seen him before, and I since learned that he was trained at Treasury for combat shooting by my trainer and longtime mentor Lee Eccles. Lee had taught me the combat shooting, that same move, to gain a drawing advantage, and I just reacted to it. I knew what it was. When he saw me react, he had already brought his hand closer to the grip, but then he opened it, retracted it in a nonverbal communique as if to say, "Okay, you got me. I'm backing off." And then he started backing down off the hill. I think he was a pro, brought out to be the shooter. He was fading for a covered shot when he saw I was handling him, just as he had been taught to do by Lee. He feared he might be outmatched professionally, so he retreated, to be followed by the others of the semicircle. The numerous videos I have of their visits really makes for a great Laurel and Hardy comedy. In the moments leading up to that confrontation, one of the BLM bureaucrats, Glenn Miller, started shaking so bad he could hardly stand up. They all knew that though they were following orders, they were in the wrong, and feeling that negative energy slowed them down both mentally and physically. They knew they were in the wrong and I was in the right. I had the edge. They didn't. They decided not to try to get me to draw. That was their plan, as later admitted to me by Castro Giovanni. But when it got right down to it, none was willing to bet their lives that Dave Patterson would be able to shoot me in the back fast enough before I killed a couple of them. So finally, they brought criminal charges against me for willfully damaging vegetation, a statute that was only applicable in a national park, not on a mine where vegetation has to be cleared to work. They allege I had damaged a Joshua tree because it was near some materials that was growing crooked. When I pointed out this to this New Yorker, who had never seen a Joshua tree before, that they grew that way naturally, and showed them others up on a ridge that you can't climb to, I asked if I was going to be charged for those also, or did they recognize that nature doesn't follow man-made plans. Then they changed the citation to read for grading sagebrush from one of the mine access roads, which of course I did to avoid starting a fire with mufflers. All in all, they invaded me at least 50 times in force. 4 times during that ordeal, I got calls warning me of night ops they were launching to plant me with drugs. I was ready for them each time. 2 of those times, we exchanged gunfire. I was never able to get a real night's sleep after that. Every attorney I talked to wanted to cop a plea for a $100 fine. I knew it would be the first and cheapest nail in my coffin, so I refused, and I went to Wayne Hage and studied law with him. Not having the bar or academia to lead me down the primrose path, ignoring any study of jurisdiction, they just tell you, the judge has it, we're here to show you how to win the judge's heart and some mind, forget about the jurisdiction. So I started at the beginning. It didn't take long to recognize the truth. The feds don't have even the remotest grounds to claim ownership. They say now they have always claimed ownership of state lands. That's a lie, and it's a product of the 1976 FLTMA, the Federal Land Policy Management Act, which was created their jurisdiction out of thin air, as you'll understand if you really look at it. By now, they had broken me financially, and I qualified for a federal public defender. Alex Modabber was assigned to me, and he said, real simple, $100 and it goes away. And I replied, it's $100 to set the match that burns me out. You know, they'd already tried that once. They burned half my place to the ground. When I explained the truth, he agreed to listen. He had to plead me and defend me if I wanted a trial. I brought several learned friends, Storm over the Rangelands, and we spent a week teaching him historical law. The renowned Franny Forrestman, formerly a hotshot at the town's biggest law firm, saw the research and she joined the case. They decided that under the circumstances, the proper legal maneuver was to file a motion for dismissal, citing the lack of federal jurisdiction over the place. Franny was eagerly looking forward to arguing the case in open court, knowing in advance that what she did would prove that the system that employs her is based on a fraud, and once exposed, there would no longer be a place for her to go to work at. But that was her dream. And her dreams were dashed when the BLM realized it would leave them all without jobs, so the judge dismissed the case in the interest of justice, saying, well, everyone knows we own the land. Interest of justice, my Aunt Minnie. They'd spent at least $50,000 to $100,000 of taxpayer funds out at my place, plus their legal costs, to try to get $100 from me. Is this not evidence of a criminal undertaking? Not one single radio station or news mag beyond Worldwide Christian Radio and Media Bypass would pick up the story. Man beats feds in criminal court by proving they are without any legal authority they claim their existence on. If you have the kind of federal problem that Clive and Bunny has, go to the courthouse and search the case United States versus Patrick McMillan. It was in 1993, Las Vegas Federal Court, the Ninth Circuit, and get a copy of the motion for dismissal and the court's dismissal document. These two documents are the magic bullet. All you have to do is just Xerox them in any criminal case or even a civil case you have with them, and it's going to put them down. They won't let that happen in court. They'll dismiss the case. So I decided to sue them all in a Title 42 1983 case, suppression under the color of office, also known as a Bivens action. There were several hundred defendants to uncover and name. I was able to serve Bruce Babbitt, the Secretary of the Interior, and most of the big shots. We were in court a year. I did all of the legal research and writing myself. There were 61 exchanges of briefs. As a side note, I began to find that a lot of cases cited against me when I researched them actually worked better for me. So I think there must have been some rarely honest clerk who was sneaking these cites to me in open disguise as their federal weapon fire. Finally, I had them on the ropes, so they demanded a discovery of my evidence. I sent them about 30 hours of video, including interviews I did of five BLM agents on tape, where they admitted that they knew they were acting in conspiracy but had no choice if they wanted to be able to feed their families. Castro Giovanni was the only one of the government people who accepted my invitation to come into the house. And when he saw my rogues gallery on the wall with many of the nation's best-known State Department and intelligence officials, he realized he'd been set up by the local thugs. He quickly came clean with me, saying that he didn't want any part of it. He was a huge and mean-looking and acting guy. I mean, just towered over me, probably about 250. I'm 5'7", 150 pounds. He admitted he was scripted to scare the daylights out of me and distract me to get me to draw on him so one of the others could shoot me resisting arrest. Three of my closest friends were filming the assault that day, including Roger McCarthy, who was the most highly decorated hero of modern times, having received the CIA's Secret Medal of Valor three times while still living. Roger was formerly the chief of station of Laos, Cambodia, and Vietnam, and he was head of I-Corps, if you remember that from MASH. And he was able to take command of the situation and he got them to back down. But then they decided to take my gun away from me on my own property. Roger had spent his last 10 years as station chief in Burma, including Tibet. He was known as Sir Roger, and he and a couple of guys still living here in Las Vegas were responsible for training the Tibetans in guerrilla warfare to resist the Chi-Coms. Roger was so incensed at what he witnessed. Things like this don't go on in the America I spent 30 years abroad fighting to protect. He was so incensed he decided to write a book to expose Harry. He had already written a book, Tears of the Lotus, a 100-year history of Tibet. It's expensive, normally read only by State Department and intel types, so he needed to write another book to establish himself as a serious, well-read writer before attacking Harry. That book, Our Republican Peril, was on the Times bestseller list for several years. He finally finished the expose of Harry just a few days before he passed away. I think Pinky will be made available to the public in the near future. I'm hoping so. And just a side note about the Tears of the Lotus. When the Dalai Lama saw that, when he read that, he took great umbrage with it and asked the State Department for an opportunity to confront Roger. And Roger obliged him, and he went to Tibet and spent a lot of time with him, actually a couple of weeks the first time. And the Dalai Lama realized he'd been wrong to let Hitler come in and use the country, and he apologized to the world, and he apologized to Roger, and the two of them became the greatest friends. In fact, every time they would be seen in public, he would always introduce Roger as my greatest friend in this life. So the five recorded interviews of the BLM personnel that I used in the suit are prima facie evidence of a government conspiracy. And if it ever became public, the federal government, as we knew it, would get neutered. So what do you think the court did? You guessed it. They dismissed the case. I took it all the way to the Supreme Court, first the Ninth Circuit, then a writ of certiorari, then the Supreme Court. And William Rehnquist wrote the opinion when they refused to hear it. I quote him, "Since we do not allow pro se litigants to win at the Supreme Court level, it was the district court judge's duty to dismiss the case early on to save the court's valuable time." In other words, if you can't afford to hire one of our Lodge brothers who can make a deal in camera, the heck with you. Law no longer exists. Sure, there are statutes and regulations, but if there was law, those statutes and regulations would be applied to everyone equally, regardless of wealth, position, or acquaintance. So I have proof from the Supreme Court of the United States that there is no law, proving our government and political body are in the hands of anarchists. The aforementioned facts are sufficient alone to defend against any federal criminal complaint, or civil for that matter, in an honest court of law. Now comes the icing on the cake, the Eisenhower brief. Shortly after winning against the criminal charge, I was asked to do 3 hours a night, 5 nights on Worldwide Christian Radio, where I interviewed many former intelligence insiders, including Roger, and even Henry Kissinger called in one night a little drunk, maybe a lot drunk, and I think he was a little pissed off at me. But I became a lightning rod for whistleblowers through that. And through them, I learned about the Eisenhower brief, which is the interdepartmental study of federal jurisdiction within the states, which was done by the U.S. Attorney General in concert with all states' attorneys general, all solicitors general of all federal agencies, and all the U.S. attorneys. Federal employees who lived on government facilities complained that their kids' schooling was substandard, and the feds held that where they had jurisdiction, only their opinion was recognized, substandard or not. At that time, no one could explain to Truman how federal land jurisdiction was claimed, so he ordered the study. It was finally presented to Eisenhower in April of 1954. It was about 800 pages. It's in two volumes. Each author wanted his place in history, and, you know, they just didn't stop writing. I told them to condense it and put it to about 25 pages and put in a list of all the claimed land in the inventory and attach it. A former IRS investigator I met only once willed his paperback copy to me. I read it probably 30 times in 5 years, each time unearthing a new fact of the conspiracy. The Atomic Energy Commission made an ironclad case against any claim the feds had any responsibility of jurisdiction anywhere. You should read it to see why. But to see the whole truth, you must find a print version, not redacted, which will be really tough to do since, you know, you can't find them anywhere. No government agency will provide it for you. You got to find somebody who's got one of the originals. I found a version in the Cornell Law Library that media that when you read the two alongside of each other, when you come to the redacted word or paragraph or page, it's a roadmap to understanding how the report clearly proves the claim of jurisdiction is a myth. Just understanding and charging from this brief alone proves in a lawful court that the Fed's land claims are bogus and conspiratorial. This is killer weapon number two. Number three is the result of Ike's order to abbreviate that report, and it's called the inventory report of the interdepartmental study of federal jurisdiction within the states. And it was presented to JFK in July of 61. He ordered it to be hidden away in the GSA library. I was tipped to its existence by an anonymous caller to the show, and I was able to get it with a FOIA. I had been unable to get it with a FOIA. They kept stonewalling me. So one of my longtime friends I had interviewed on that program was Admiral Ernest Fitzgerald, who was chief of cost oversight accounting for the Pentagon. Ernie became famous when he was fired for blowing the whistle on the C-5A scandal during the Nixon administration, where money was diverted from buying strong American-made airplane parts. And the Pentagon was outsourcing for counterfeit parts, which ultimately cost the lives of a lot of our boys. But when the Nixon tapes came out, there was a passage from Nixon on there saying, we've got to get rid of that G.D. Fitzgerald before he puts us all in the penitentiary. It was that tape that got him reinstated. So Ernie, who loved what I was doing, set out to find the document. He ended up at the GSA library, where all originals are housed, and it took him 2 weeks to find it. He had to go back through the numbered entry page books, the index, to find it. It was marked not for public dissemination, not to be removed from the GSA library. Initially, he was refused access, but when he told them that he had the ability to call for a 6 o'clock live newscast, and he was going to, and this guy was going to prevent a guy with the highest security clearance in the nation from seeing a legal document, the public would begin asking questions. So he finally agreed to let Ernie read it in the office. At one point, Ernie was able to slip it into an autocopier in the office and make a copy, which he got out. The 800 pages were now about 25 pages, but with a national inventory of every parcel claimed by the feds in the states. There's only one place in print where federal jurisdiction is set forth. This is the Constitution of Federal Authority. There were five categories of jurisdiction claimed. Number one is exclusive jurisdiction as defined for lands under Article 1, Section 8, Clause 17. Number 2 and 3 were loosely described as a joint jurisdiction with the local sheriff, which is clearly impossible if one is to consider that the 10th Amendment is real, which I fought for 20 years ago, got the Nevada governor to sign, and of course then he promptly stepped on it. I'll skip to number 5 for just a minute because it was a nothing, a blank page to be filled in if ever needed. There wasn't a single parcel of land identified as Category 5, and of course that just evidences the pervasiveness of fraud in government. Leave blank pages to fill in later. But let's get back to number 4, which is called proprietary jurisdiction. And it's what we have in our homes. We can refuse entry to those we don't want to come, but just because they come in anyway, we don't have the right or the authority to arrest, try to execute them. We must call a lawful peace officer. So what is it? What does it say that the government can claim that they can do on Category 4 land? And I quote, Category 4 jurisdiction is that area within a state where the federal government has acquired some right or title. Now let's stop here for a moment. Remember, title to property is proof you don't have lodial title. You have feudal title at best, but you clearly do not own the property. So claiming any jurisdiction of any land under the Category 4 category is the government's prima facie admittance that they have no legal right to land. So I'll restart. Category 4 jurisdiction is that area within a state where the federal government has acquired some right or title, but has in no way acquired any of the state's jurisdiction. In no way acquired any of the state's jurisdiction. And this is why they always bring local cops or sheriffs, and when they do, they're all conspirators in numerous 10th Amendment violations, including the local cops they bring. When I searched the Nevada inventory, all of the land that was claimed was at Category 4 jurisdiction, where they have in no way acquired any of the state's jurisdiction, the exception of the Hawthorne Magazine and a few scattered post offices claimed as Category 1. Less than 1.5% of all of Nevada's lands, not 85%. This alone unmasks them. But I've saved the best for last, the Lopez decision. It was 110 pages, one of the longest I've ever read. April 26, 1995. Texas. I've asked literally hundreds of judges and lawyers, and not one of them has ever admitted to having even heard of the most important Supreme Court decision of the 20th century. So I condensed the hot parts into a six-pager. It was published in a lot of locals and some magazines. You can find it in the December 95 edition of Media Bypass that has the blown-up McMurrah building on the front of it. And that case was about a gun. The feds wanted an easy case to get a precedent case for their new law, Title 18, Section 922Q1A. And in order to assert more jurisdiction, they took this case away from a state who had filed a good case. It was they would have gotten a conviction. So it backfired on them. And there are a few high points in the court here are a few of the high points that the court found. Rehnquist wrote the overall opinion. To uphold that the government's contention that it can bring charges for a crime alleged to have been committed in a state would require this court to pile inference upon inference in a manner that would bid fair to convert the Congressional Commerce Authority to a general police power of the sort held only by the states. Now, what was reviling in 1995 is what we're living with today. Chief Justice John Marshall made it clear years ago, for all time to come, that under the U.S. Constitution, the federal government was specifically restrained from exercising any police power whatsoever, not enumerated in the Constitution, period. Also, that Congress lacks constitutional authority under the Commerce Clause to enact criminal laws or statutes enforceable for acts alleged to have occurred within the states. Justice Sandra Day O'Connor wrote, unfortunately, most government officials have convenient amnesia when it comes to observing their responsibilities. It's up to the people to continually remind them, both by admonition of their failures on a case-by-case basis and at the polls. Lopez held clearly that the Commerce Clause was never meant to convey any police power to it, but to let it act solely as a judge when disputed business matters became interstate. Which state would have venue? Which court would be used? Period. The court also found that the Commerce Clause gave the federal government no more authority in regulating the Constitution or the construction of firearms or who should possess firearms than they had authority to enter the bedroom and say what could be done there. Now for the epilogue. One afternoon after I learned the Supreme Court had thrown my case out, two BLM thugs and two Metro thugs came out to visit me. The lead Metro thug did the talking. I'll bet you're pretty proud at being the first one to meet us in court, but we were just wondering, how many times are you going to go to sleep out here wondering if tonight is the night? I got the message. By that time, I developed high blood pressure, and my wife had gotten fed up and left. My kids thought I was crazy to resist. I finally had to just walk away from it all. I was broke. But it was probably the best thing that could have happened. Being broke, I could go in any direction I wanted. It was all going to be a startup. And as it happened, the direction I chose led me to the three greatest discoveries in all of the universe, but that's a subject for another time. What you need to take away from all of this is that even those whom you think are champions of right, many if not most of them, still have clouded minds when they hear these false federal claims. I heard Megyn Kelly say on Fox News, well, he hasn't paid his fees and he makes racist slurs, when the truth is the fees are a fraud and he was misquoted as to the slurs. But champion of the right Megyn has already thrown him under the bus without further quest for facts. They all swallow whatever sounds plausible. Nothing will stop the feds from flaunting the law and lying to the public unless and until the majority of people know what they're doing and we put up a common front. Otherwise, they're going to take us all one by one. They don't come after us altogether. The word out, there is no law in the United States. Everyone else in the world knows it. It's time the sheeple learn the truth of what is silently surrounding them, or they'll perish in blind ignorance. Epilogue number two. I let myself be convinced by Charles Collins to run for Nevada's 2nd District Republican primary in 96. Though I knew my platform would never sell, I had standing to sue the Clark County Registrar of Voters, Catherine Ferguson, and her fraudulent Sequoia Pacific voting scandal. I had researched and come to the conclusion that the only way a voting machine can be held accountable for its math is if it issues you a receipt where you can go to a master board or master books later to compare your numbered receipt to verify that your votes were counted as you put them on your receipt. And since there are no such machines in existence, we must assume that they're all a fraud. I had devoted several hours to the subject on Freedom Radio Network and got an anonymous tip from a Clark County Registrar of Voters office employee with instructions and the phone codes to call a Clark County machine and change vote totals by keypad. I intended to subpoena the machine and demonstrate it in open court. They must have figured out I knew something because the judge, Lloyd George, threw the case out, citing, and listen to this one, the dilution of the vote is not a constitutional issue and therefore not a federal case. My Aunt Millie, if voting integrity isn't protected by the Constitution, then nothing else is protected either. There is no Constitution anymore. They used it to, Lloyd George then became the first judge to have a federal courthouse named after him while he was still living. The Las Vegas Federal Courthouse is the Lloyd George Federal Building. He was the same judge, by the way, who threw Dick Carver's case in the toilet back in 94 when he came out and championed with Richard Mack and all of those other great guys. And that's my story, and I'm sticking to it.
Well, I'll tell you what, Patrick, I just feel blessed that we're getting some of this information for the first time here at Walls in Our Minds, and I'm really thankful that that you've come here and shared this with us tonight. I'll be one of the first people to buy that book, I'll tell you. And our listeners, we're getting a lot of messages in chat here too that, you know, talking about how amazing this information is. And Linda, did you get some questions that were raised? If I launch off into mine, I'm not even sure where to start with all the questions in my mind, but I'm going to give Red a live mic too. Patrick, you may have heard the name Red Beckman.
Yeah, Red and I met 20-some-odd years ago up in somewhere in Montana. I can't remember where. It was briefly, but I certainly know what a hero he is.
Well, Red, you want to say hello? You might need to unmute yourself. You were making a little noise earlier, so I...
Hi, Red.
I've been listening, my hearing, I think, improved in the process. I remember that Lopez case so well, and I sued a federal judge. I sued the senior federal judge in Montana in 1993, and that case was docketed with the U.S. Supreme Court in August of 96. And as far as we know, it's still docketed there, and I think it'll stay there. They've got it so well hidden that you can't find it on the computers. Any government agent that gets a check, a paycheck from the government, tax money. Anybody, and that can be the janitor in the federal building or the federal judge at the top of the heap, but they all have a very serious conflict of interest in any controversy. And I use that word controversy because that's what we've got in the 7th article of the Bill of Rights. Any controversy over $20, we have the right to a common law grand or common law jury, and that's how I had had four actions that I had filed starting in 77, where I demanded jury trials, and the judge had, on motion from the Justice Department, had summarily thrown me out, even with no hearing or anything else. And, of course, in each and every case, I demanded a jury trial. However, I wasn't up to speed by any means, and I was just getting my feet wet at that time. And there's my feet are still in the water, I think, sometimes. But when I sued the judge in 93 on the cover sheet, on the cover in that right-hand column where all it got is the judge's name and the case number at the top, I wrote in below that, all facts to be tried by Seventh Amendment common law jury. And that, we have had a tremendous amount of success, like with tax court and such, using, even in traffic situations, we've been able to use that. And so we've turned the corner. Pat, we're... you have learned a lot over the years, and I have learned a lot, and there's a lot more people out there just like us.
There's something we have to remember, and nobody really forms it in their mind. Everybody's got some idea in their mind, but to really look at it clearly, there are only two kinds of people in the world. One kind of person will do whatever it takes to never offend or never hurt anybody else, period. The other kind of person, and all the rest of the people who aren't like the first kind of person are the second person, they'll do whatever it takes to get what they want at the time. And when you look at the federal employees, that's what they are. That's a perfect example. Hey, they're getting paid for it. They don't care whether it's legal or not. The court says it is, the boss says it is, and they're getting paid for it, and they're going to do it, and I don't have to use my brain to see if I'm doing right or wrong, because everybody else is doing it.
You're absolutely correct. But, you see, they anybody that is a threat to their great pension plan, their health care plan, their great vacations and all, anybody that's a threat, the threat may be 100% correct, but they are going to try to save or they'll harass the guy that's correct. They'll harass him to try to silence him.
Right. And the Affordable Care Act is their last-ditch effort because Obama, all those people know they're gonna get caught. You know, that whole regime is gonna fall. But he wants the Health Care Act to survive because that controlling medicine is the long arm of the New World Order. As long as the government controls medicine, they control everything you do. And of course, now they already control the food. Nobody knows it, but they control all the food. They've made the food poisonous by letting ADM and all those other big companies, Cargill and so forth, produce stuff that's poisonous to us and just force it down our throats to make us sick so then they can mediate out the health care and or the appearance of health care so that they can kill us off. Are you familiar with the biodiversity treaty?
Oh, yes.
So they promised 176 countries all signed the agreement that by 2015 they would reduce the world's population to what it was, to 15% of what it was in 1996, I think.
Mm-hmm.
And they're on target.
They're on target, and of course I don't know your age, but I'm 85 and pushing 86, and my missus is 85 too. And, of course, we're raising a garden, and we've got fruit and a lot of things, and our own chickens, and we're trying to stay healthy, but I'll tell you, with arthritis and heart problems and a few other things, the only thing that's keeping me going is my faith in the great physician.
And you've got a better shot at it than most people because most people live in horizontal post office boxes and they don't have any dirt to grow food in.
Yeah. But I don't mind getting dirt under my fingernails, and I love it, and tell you the truth. That's where I prefer to spend most of my time if I can. But I've got to start another action here in Montana. I'm in Washington State right now, but I lost one of my brothers about 18 months ago, and I'm the court-appointed administrator of his estate. And so I've got a case where I'll be filing it, I hope, within the next month, in Montana, in federal court, and because the State Department of Revenue in the state of Montana has a lien on his estate, and myself, too, and because of inheritance coming from my parents' property. And of course, I'm the co-author of the book, The Law That Never Was. And well, I'm the guy that started the process of researching that in June of 1980. And so I'm going to bring that 16th Amendment question up in that action. And it's going to be interesting to see if they come along and say, well, I don't have standing. Well, I think that I'll have standing. And, of course, the lawsuit will be filed under Rule 38 of the Federal Rules of Civil Procedure that that provide for Seventh Amendment common law jury trials. And, of course, in tax court and some other courts, we've been able to neutralize the judge pretty well by filing a judicial notice noting how that they have that serious conflict of interest and that the jury, the common law jury, a Seventh Amendment common law jury, that is the highest court in the land. The Supreme Court is not able to interfere with that Seventh Amendment common law jury.
Let me ask you, Red, how many defendants are there going to be?
There will be just the State Department of Revenue and the Internal Revenue Service, both of them.
How many individuals are you going to name?
I don't
Does.
Think I will name any individuals at this point.
No does?
I think that the summons will go out to the Treasury head in the Montana, or the probably go to the Attorney General in the state of Montana. And I've been contemplating and thinking and cogitating on who to send the one to the IRS, and I think we'll send that to the District Council.
Okay, well, let me tell you about a case you may or may not have heard about. Typically, when you're suing a government agency, you're going to have a number of individuals. You know, maybe it's two, maybe it's, in my case, about 700. And what happens is the U.S. attorney gets them an attorney, so they're all represented by one attorney.
Mm-hmm.
Now, my friend Ernie Fitzgerald, when he was suing them, they had one attorney, and he realized that they were just going to dangle him out there and just run him broke. So he sued the U.S. attorney. His name was Harlow. The case is called Harlow v. Fitzgerald. And what the case, the judge decided, and it's always been held since then, is what Ernie argued. He says, listen, Judge, what if I win this case and all of these defendants are convicted? Every one of them is going to claim they didn't get an adequate defense because they didn't have their own attorney. And you can imagine what that's going to cost the court, 700 cases. So you as the judge have to right now tell these people they can't all use one attorney. They all have to have their own attorney so they can't come back and overburden the court system. And the judge agreed. And every one of them had to get an attorney. I killed them with it.
Oh, my. Yeah, I can imagine.
Harlow
well,
D.
You see,
Fitzgerald.
In my case, my battle with the IRS goes back to 1974. And most of the actors in that are long since gone. They're dead.
Yeah.
And you know, it's rather interesting because I think well, including that federal judge that I sued, he's gone. He's met the great judge of the universe. And so I I've really been debating on that one. I think that naming the or the summons will go to the Attorney General, I'm pretty sure, in the state of Montana.
Well, the more people you can name, even if you don't think you can take them all the way to the mat, the more people you can name and file that Bivens action, file that Harlow v. Fitzgerald, the more you're going to hurt them, and they're going to start dancing around like they're on a hot tin roof, and they'll start making mistakes because there'll be so many people involved in trying to save their own necks that they'll fight each other.
I think that we're at a situation right now where I say there isn't a government employee, and that goes for the janitor in the federal building and all the way up to the judges. There isn't anyone out there that doesn't know that this nation is in serious trouble, that our government, well, basically what has happened is our nation has been conquered by enemies of the
conquered from within.
What?
It's been conquered from within.
Conquered from within, absolutely. And I think that this Seventh Amendment, I've talked to a number of attorneys, and I've never found one yet that understood what the Seventh Article of the Bill of Rights was all about.
Well, none of them understand the law because the interpretation of the law is what was taught to them by the Bar Association in those colleges, not the real law.
Yeah.
Attorneys don't go in and look at the real law unless it's their skin. They don't go to the bottom of it.
What I have been saying is that in 1791, when the Bill of Rights was attached to the Constitution and all of the colonies agreed and ratified the Constitution, I believe that at that point, the Bar Association, which is managed and directed out of London, England, the Bar Association has spent all of these years trying their best to drop the Seventh Amendment through the cracks, and they've been pretty successful up to this point. But now, when we've got a bigger percentage, well, I do some talk radio and such, and I try to tell our listeners that we have a different audience than we had a year ago. We've got a drastically different audience than what we had 10 years ago because people are getting angry, and they're wondering what in the world has happened to this great country. And so we now have... Well, we may be getting close to 5%. It was about 5% that fought and won the War of Independence, and we're probably close to 5% of the people that would pick up arms at this point, without any problem, any conscience problem. I think they'd
well,
be
after
ready
what
to
I
fight.
Saw, what after what I saw at Cliven's place a couple of weeks ago, I believe that.
Yeah, and. Of course, in Montana, we kind of rejuvenated the Montana militia. Not militia, the Montana vigilantes. It was the vigilantes of Montana that brought law and order to that territory back in the 1860s. And so vigilante action is a heritage of people in Montana.
Yeah.
And it's probably stronger there than just about any place in the United States because of what we did in the last, it's been 40 years for me. And at the beginning, I couldn't see any other way of getting out of this mess other than a second revolution. People say, oh...
It is the only way.
I'd say, well, the second revolution, that's already, conquered this nation. We've got to go back and You see, the second revolution started there back in the 1791s and two. That's when it started, when them lawyers coming, you know, under English control, tried to, you know, take over this country. And they've done pretty well. They've been pretty successful.
And part of the
days are numbered now.
Yeah, part of the problem is, and I've never talked about this publicly because it's kind of a touchy subject. But if you ask people where our law comes from, most people will tell you it comes from the Constitution. And it actually doesn't. It comes from the Declaration of Independence, which forever forbid martial law. And the Constitution restored it. Initially, the people weren't going to accept the Constitution because they could see all the loopholes in it, and that's when they came up with the Bill of Rights that said, doesn't this protect you? Of course, no one ever realized that, you know, the Bill of Rights will only be recognized by judges who feel it might help their case or the prosecutor's case. So the problem is the Constitution really pulled the wool over our eyes as far as, you know, who can do what. The feds don't have any power. And via the Declaration of Independence and the Constitution gave them power, or the appearance of power, that we really never meant them to have.
Well, I'll tell you, the key is the fact that we got those government public education with Horace Mann back in the 1830s. By 1850, we had public education, and so we had institutionalized ignorance.
Yes,
And you see, the IRS was not, it's a domestic terrorist organization. It was not created by Congress. It was created by 12 people that had been educated in these government schools. And see, education and smarts are two different things.
Yes.
And so
education these days is brainwashing.
Yeah, they've ruined the word education.
Yes.
Red calls it brain soiling.
Yeah, it's.
I'll go along with that.
Yeah, but I'll tell you, I'm amazed at how people are waking up and. They're grabbing at good, solid information when it's available, and, of course, the Internet has been doing pretty well. What they have to learn, of course, is that the government has their shills also putting out stuff on the Internet. And if you're, you know, a little bit, you know, clued in a little bit, you can sort them out pretty quick.
I remember a time back when I was about 8 years old, and our next-door neighbor who worked for the Los Angeles County Board of Education told my mother something that my mother thought after that she was a nut. She just wouldn't even talk to her. UNESCO was just getting its foot into education here, and she told my mother that if UNESCO got its foothold, it would eventually destroy the freedom of this country.
Mm.
And my mother thought she was a nut, but she was on the money.
I have a daughter here that raised 5 children. The youngest is 19 now, and she homeschooled all 5. And of course, having a grandpa that
had his picture in the post office
camper, before they were ever born or before my daughter was ever married, and all they had a little advantage, I think. But the difference in those children, it's just absolutely amazing. The one daughter went to work, I think she was only 17, for an outfit that tests eyes and sell glasses, eyeglasses and such. She was managing. There's a company with 47 different stores. And before she was 21, she was managing one of those stores. And the last I heard, her store was number 2 out of 47 as far as sales and effectiveness.
Red made the most wanted list of the SPLC.
The kids are computer wise, and there's something there. There's something that's missing in these public school kids. And these homeschool kids picked it up somehow. None of them have gone to college, and I think they're all making more money than my grandkids that have gone to college.
Sure, college actually will hold them back, because all it does is prepare them to get a little better, a little higher step on the ladder when it comes to going to work to be a mediocre worker.
I have a granddaughter that graduated civil engineering. She's working on a government job right now because they offered her $56,000 a year to start with in the Defense Department. Her father, my son, he kept her clued in all the time she was going to school, and she graduated with a 3.99 average.
Wow.
Magnus cum laude, I guess they call it, or something
cum
like
laude.
That.
Cum laude.
Because she, she had another resource available, and she's been very effective, and she's looking for something beside a government job today.
Good for her.
So I hope she'll find it. She will.
I'm sure she will.
Yeah.
Red, of course, boasts of his PhD. That's for post hole digging.
Yeah.
Yeah. I just. You know, I've studied so much, and now I'm having these minor mini strokes, I guess you call them, and so it's hurt my short-term memory pretty serious. But,
well, maybe we should talk offline, and I'll tell you how I've cured a lot of the problems that you have. In 2010, I got up off the operating table. They were ready to cut me open to do a quadruple bypass, and what was wrong with me would not have been solved by doing the quadruple bypass, but it's the most profitable thing they do in medicine now. So 85% of them are unnecessary. So I spent a lot of time in research since, and I've devoted the last 8 or 10 years into getting it back into perfect health, which I've done pretty good. In fact, I just beat the incurable bladder cancer, which I got by taking pharmaceutical drugs. I don't do any pharmaceutical drugs of any kind anymore. In fact, I'm allergic to them all.
Well, I have a daughter-in-law that turned up with colon cancer about 16, 17 months ago, and the doctors, they were going to do chemo and radiation and everything else, and the family said, no, don't do that. And she seems to be getting along pretty well. So that chemo and such, she'd have been dead now.
Well, we should talk later, and I can tell you some of the things I've learned that will help her. And
we know how to take care of the strokes now. We learned that.
Are you off sugar?
What?
Are you off of sugar?
Pretty well. We limit. I have my own honeybees.
Honey is sugar, Red.
What?
Honey is sugar.
If
you really want to be,
if you use too much, it can be
bad
too.
No, that's a cop out. Any amount, if you go on a sugar free diet, and I mean a sugar free diet, you can cure just about any illness there is. Cancer can't live without sugar in your blood. It can't. You have to be sugar free.
Yeah, we have one of those water machines that put out the oxygenated water, and that's something. I think has real value. And of course I have a Rife machine, and those Rife machines got to be pretty good because they banned them. The government passed a law that said you couldn't have one for many years.
Well, there's some
so
Russian machines.
Been pretty good.
There's some Russian machines now that are far outdistanced the Rife. I've been working with some people in those for the last 10 years, and it's pretty astounding. But people will tell me that they're off sugar, and then I'll ask them what they had for breakfast, and they'll tell me, well, they had some cereal and they had some milk. People just don't understand that sugar is in almost everything. Now, I've made a list of every food there is that has no sugar in it or has sugar in it that your body can handle. And if you get on that list, within a couple of years, not only will all your physical problems seem to disappear, but the memory problems, the cognitive problems, doing math and that you thought was old age, it isn't. It's from the sugar. All of that came back to me. I didn't expect it because no one's ever done it before. I was the first one to ever go absolutely zero sugar. And I cured my diabetes, my peripheral neuropathy, which is incurable, loss of testosterone, liver cancer, prostate cancer, and now I just knocked out the bladder cancer. Of course, it wasn't just with the no sugar diet. I have something else I use too. But if you're interested, I can email you the list. And if you get on that list and you don't eat anything that has an ingredient in it that's not on that list, you'll find within 6 to 8 months. All of your physical problems will be gone, and within 2 years you'll have the mental faculties you had as a youngster. The only sugar that you can safely eat is fructose that comes in fruit. But the key here is the fruit must ripen on the tree, and that's the problem. They picked the fruit green so it's soft in the market. Now, it didn't ripen. It putrefied.
Yeah.
That's why it got soft.
Yeah. Yeah.
So it means going to the farmer and buying your produce and going out there, and I pick it myself. I get about 200 pounds of peaches, and what I don't eat during season, I take the seed out and I puree them and I put it in bottles and I freeze it, and I use that on everything. That's my sweet. I use it on my eggs and my sweet and sour sauce instead of applesauce on pork chops, you know, in anything. I make it in everything, and it really makes a lot of delicious dishes. And you know, the pounds just melt. Once you're on this diet, even with zero exercise, you'll lose at least a quarter to a half a pound a day until you get down to a nice trim weight. And doing exercise, by the way, when you're overweight, does not take the weight off. It puts more weight on because it increases your metabolism. The only time doing exercise does any good is when you're sitting there and saying, I got to get up and move. I just can't sit around here. And then when you've got the energy to burn off, that's when you do exercise. But forced exercises are killing people.
Now, I started at 235, and this morning when I weighed, I was 194.
Good for you.
On that
diet, I lost 72 pounds in 90 days. And when I went back to my doctor, and he says, you've committed suicide. And I said, what are you talking about? And he says, no one can starve themselves at that rate without destroying their liver. You're dead. You're just a few days away. And I said, wait a minute. I didn't starve myself. I ate like a horse. But during that time, I had developed a non-glycemic sugar. So I made testing, and I made all kinds of desserts. Anything you make with sugar, I made with my non-glycemic sugar. And eating that and the stuff on my list, in 90 days I dropped the 72 pounds. And I even had brought a pie for him to taste, and he wouldn't taste it. And I had told him the last time I'd seen him before that, in May 1st of 06, I said, your drugs are killing me. You know, I can't take it anymore. I'm getting off the drugs. I'm going to find another way. He said, you'll be dead in 6 months. And I says, okay, but at least, you know, the pain will be gone and I'll be out of it. But I want to ask you, what if I figure out how to beat this without all those drugs? Is that something you'd want to pass on to your patients? And he said, well, certainly. So when I came back 90 days later looking like a weightlifter, he looked at my blood test and he says, well, there's a big mistake here. This isn't yours. An 18-year-old living on a desert island eating nothing but raw food couldn't have these numbers. You got to go have the tests again. So I went and did the tests again, and they were the same. And he had to write on my report, diabetes mellitus cured by his diet and exercise. And I have that report. It says exactly that, cured by diet and exercise. Of course, there wasn't any exercise, but that's what he had to say. Let me finish. I told him, I said, I'll get with your nurse now and explain to her the diet and everything. And he says, well, that won't be necessary. And I said, well, I thought you said you'd want to pass this on to your patients. And he says, well, that was before I knew you could do it. And I said, isn't that interesting? I got a friend who's a news reporter down at Channel 3, I bet he'd like to talk to you about that. Channel 3 is the big station in Vegas. So the next morning at 10 o'clock, he rented a half hour on Channel 3 to announce that he was retiring from practice because he was going blind. He owned all four of the nephrology and endocrinology institute offices in Nevada, which were the only ones if you had those problems to go to. And, you know, he was facing losing his business where he had probably 100 doctors working if he got in front of a camera. And David Riggleman asked him, you know, how come you won't pass this on if it cures diabetes and you aren't curing it, you're just maintaining it?
Yeah, my daughter-in-law with the colon cancer, she has been very, very careful about no sugar. She's really been sticking to her diet.
Well, I would bet there's at least one or two things in there she doesn't realize has sugar. So get your email address to me, and I'll send you this list.
Yeah.
I'll forward all that.
Anything like that. We lost our oldest son to melanoma cancer a couple of years ago. And, you know, he was diagnosed too late. And because he'd been going to a chiropractor, and the chiropractor finally told him that he couldn't help him and sent him to a medical doctor, and 60 days later he was gone.
Well, if a guy's got 60 days left, if they've got 30 days left, if they've got 2 weeks left, and they get on this diet and this water that I've developed, the odds are pretty good they're going to cure it.
Well,
I can't promise that it does, but I've had an awful lot of friends who have cured their cancer, and coincidentally, they were doing what I told them to do.
Yeah, well, we've learned a lot since we lost him.
You want to give your website, Pastor?
I'm not sure I should. let's hold that for another time.
Yeah.
You know, this is a big enough risk for me sticking my head out for this. I don't know how far your readership goes is, but, you know, like you said, if you know something, you're in trouble. And I've kept my mouth shut for a long time, and, you know, they've left me alone. But now that my name's out there and I've given this kind of information, I'm sure I'll be a target again. So I don't want them to target that. I've got to give some thought to it to figure out before I'll release the information.
Yeah, you know, I've had.
I'll give it to you, but I'll give it to you, but I don't want to put it on the air yet.
Yeah, I've had a lot of threats over the years, and some encounters that were very, very interesting. I don't worry about those kind of things because I do have. I was born in a family that believes in an almighty God, and I've never gotten away from that. And so when my time is up, I'm ready to go. So I used to say, well, don't you know, I'd have question and answers one time right there in Reno. I had quite a large crowd, and when I went and asked for questions at the end, the question and answer time, the first thing comes up, aren't you worried about them wiping you out, rubbing you out? And I say, no, I don't worry about that at all, because if they do that, that's a promotion.
Yeah, but there's people you're going to leave behind that need you.
My wife and I had our 62nd anniversary yesterday.
Congratulations.
If I had it to do over, I'd do it again.
Good for you.
You mean you'd rescue her from where, North Dakota, or where was it?
Yeah, I rescued her from North Dakota, and if I'd left her there, she'd have probably been rich with oil now.
Pat,
yes.
you have got a very interesting history, and I can't wait to be able to talk to you some more one-on-one about it. Is what I would like to talk about for a minute and see what, you know, Red, Terry, Pat, what your input is on this. I've been doing a lot of research into The World Bank, the international community, and what we're really looking at in this country, and also worldwide. The World Bank was created in 1944, and from that came in 1948 was the International Union for Conservation of Nature. It was the first and the largest global environmental network that was created, and the United States is a member of that. From that, I've been, like I said, doing research on the international community. And you talked about the healthcare reform here, you know, the Obamacare, which actually comes from the international healthcare reform. The Common Core comes from the international, it's the Institute for International Primary Curriculum. That's where Common Core comes from. Unilever is making sure children worldwide have food in school to eat. International Aichi target dates are all set for 2020. United Nations Environmental Program. All the international programs that have been scheduled are all scheduled for 2020. Now, last year at the United Nations Environmental Program in Bonn, Germany, it was the 31st of January, the United States is one of those members in UNEP. Dr. Ann Bartuska was there, and she is the Deputy Undersecretary for the USDA today, and she sat on the National Resources Committee. But she said last year at that Bonn, Germany conference that we are scheduled, we're right on course for 2020 target dates for all emission control in this country. And there's the same program. It's now called the International Human Dimensions Program. There's going to be a massive workshop held July 16th through the 19th in Reno, Nevada. Now, these guys brought together 200 to 300 agreements from governments worldwide, which the United States is part of that, and they're creating these agreements that strengthen the international ties for global mountain requirements. So I think is what we're looking at, and is the policy influence for biodiversity in every member country of the UN. So this goes back to, it's even bigger than Agenda 21. It goes back to 1944 with the World Bank. And so is what they've done is the true outcome of their international control of where they're headed and what they have set out to do. They've masked it with these good intentions of biodiversity and guaranteeing human life on the planet. And then what they did in 1991, they searched for a new enemy that could bring the entire world together, and they came up with the idea of pollution and global warming and water right. shortages and famine and, you know, anything that fits the bill in there. My question is, we know that the feds don't have the jurisdiction that they pretend to, and that the states have the jurisdiction. In fact, in the United States, the feds only have proprietorial interest in only about 95% of the land. 5% of the land in the U.S. is held in legislative jurisdiction, right? So how do we stop them? How do we stop the World Bank? Do we step into another monetary system? What do we do? Because it ultimately comes down to the love of money, and that is the World Bank. How do we stop it, and what do we do?
Well, first of all, you say they have 95% of proprietorial jurisdiction. They do claim that via the FLTMA, the Federal Land Policy Management Act. But the truth is, they don't have any jurisdiction over it. They've never marked it and demonstrated it for a purpose to sustain life. So under the laws of every state, the property laws of every state, they are exclusively prohibited from exercising any rights on any property other than forts, arsenals, dockyards, and other needful buildings, as in Article 1. So that whole thing is a fraud. And see, they keep saying it over and over and over, and you see it in print so often you begin to believe it, or you leave that out of the argument. But that's where you attack them, is that they never had any, they don't have Category 4 jurisdiction.
Right. How do we come out from underneath the monetary system and get, we're forcing the jurisdiction, that the state jurisdiction, we're educating people, including our public officials locally on that, but how do we get them to see the big picture, and what do we do about the World Bank? That's the big ugly that we have to discuss, that has to get on the table in a serious way.
I don't think you're going to like my answer.
Okay. It's all right.
Okay. First of all, people think there's a shortage of money. There's not. There's a lot of money out there, a lot. It's just not going into circulation. And what's about to happen is we're going to lose our status as the world's reserve currency. Right now, the Russians and the Chinese, and they're inviting others to make a basket of currency to buy oil. And once that happens, we'll no longer be able to print money. Some will say that's a good thing, but without printing money, our inflation is going to go wild. It's just going to go sky high, and this country will experience a kind of inflation it's never experienced before. So when you ask how can we stop that, I don't think it's possible. You know, I've heard people say, well, Bitcoin, you know, we'll switch over to Bitcoin. The problem with Bitcoin is it requires a computer, and what's going to happen if, you know, if the computers go down? Which, you know, if the government is losing control, they will shut down the computers to shut down our ability to resist from them.
So, they've also proven they can manipulate it.
Yes. So the only shot that I can see where we can come out of this with any kind of cleanliness is if the man upstairs decides it's another time for Sodom and Gomorrah, because we don't have it within us to come together and organize to try to do something about it. First of all, if we tried to do that, we'd be claimed with inciting the overthrow of the government. So, you know, even talking about it, they'll find a way to charge us with inciting the violent overthrow of the government. And that's because they recognize they're a violent government. They rule by gun. I have to tell you a story. Some time ago, many years ago, I had a question, and I called up Lauren Malkowitz, who was the head of the Legislative Research Council Bureau for the state of Nevada, and I'd met him on the campaign trail. I liked him. And I asked him a question, and I said, Lauren, I said, what kind of a government do we have in the state of Nevada? And he says, well, it's a corporate government. And I says, oh, and the corporate seal is a little mic with a pan, and he's panning gold. And he says, yeah. I says, okay. I said, would you mind sending me a copy of your articles of incorporation? And he says, well, you get those from the Attorney General. And I had already asked her. I knew her personally, Frankie Sudol Papa. There was a time when I thought she was a decent person, but, you know, she proved her worth eventually. And she couldn't provide the articles or the bylaws. And I told him that. And he said, well, there must be some mistake. And I said, well, that's why I'm calling, Lauren. You know, where's the articles and bylaws? So he left me on the phone for about 20 minutes and finally came back, and he says, you know what? He says, you're right. We're not incorporated. State of Nevada is not incorporated. And I said, well, okay, then, you know, where does it get its authority? So he started, you know, going on about some laws and so forth. And, you know, I said, whoa, wait a minute. You know, how can you claim that authority? Why can't I claim that authority? Why can't my neighbors claim that authority? What have you got that gives you the ability to claim that authority? And he said, the most honest answer I've ever heard. He says, well, let me put it to you this way. No one's come along with more guns to try and take it away from us. And that's the bottom line. And that's why they want to take the guns. I mean, all you got to do is look at the Ukraine. I mean, for something really now, something that's going on now. The Ukrainians don't have guns. They've all been taken away. And that's what will happen. The moment the guns are taken away from us here, it's over. But it could be over before they get the guns because, you know, they're realizing that people are waking up. They're realizing they've got to make their big move quickly or they're going to lose their ability to do it. Because just, and I saw some statistics the other day, I think in just in one state, was it Wisconsin? There are enough registered gun owners in Wisconsin to put, I think, 4 people on every federal employee there is in the world. So they aren't going to, you know, let us get, they're not going to let us get enough of a battle cry. They're not going to wait until they've heard enough people that the press is really listening and the press switches over. Because once that happens, once public opinion changes, they're dead. So at some time before that point, you know, they're going to declare war on us. It'll be a false flag operation. I don't know what kind, but I'm, you know, sure it'll be one. I've learned about many of them over the years and how to create them. I mean, that's kind of one of the things that I did before I woke up, realizing what I was doing. I just don't see it coming clean. I don't.
You don't see anything, any way out of it but a revolution.
Yeah, and there's not going to be many people that will survive it because it'll shut down the food supply, electricity, heating, all the rest of that. You know, we're looking at, I really believe we're looking at the end times.
Right. Well, that's the good news, actually.
Well, it is.
That's the good news, because this has been going on for a long time. A lot of us have been involved in, you know, for 25 years, and others for, you know, read for I don't even know how many years, and it just goes and goes. That's the good news, is that, you know, we've been living to die for this, I think.
Yeah, and there's one man that's responsible for all of this, and probably nobody really knows who he is. Abraham Lincoln. Abraham Lincoln was the first Whig elected to office, the first Republican. And so, you know, he'd failed at everything he'd ever done. So the Republicans came along and says, well, Abe, you know, we got you in office. We need a little favor. The party needs $1 million. So we want the government to lend us $1 million. We don't have any collateral, but, you know, we're friends. So Abe arranged for them to get a loan of $1 million, all in gold coin, U.S. gold coin. Now, it's always been illegal to take U.S. gold coin out of the country. Now, I just want you to remember that fact. So at the turn of the century, you know, each successive president came on and found that debt. He wasn't going to step out and tell the people, hey, Abraham Lincoln stole $1 million from us. I mean, he was the great emancipator. They had to keep that covered. So no one ever knew about it. But along about the turn of the century, at 1900, there was a audit that had to be done of the federal government. It was required by law. And that $1 million was going to be missing. So along came two guys, Rothschild and, what was the other guy? The Rothschild Agreement. It'll come to me in a minute. Anyways, they stepped up the plate and they said, look, we understand you got an audit coming up and you're short $1 million and we want to help you out. So we're going to lend you $1 million and in 7 years you give us back $4 million. Well, it was kind of usury, but, you know, the government didn't have a choice, so they took the money. Now, the money came in on a plane or a boat from Switzerland and, you know, it was U.S. gold coin, so it was probably the original $1 million that he gave off without any collateral. So if you get a copy of William Jennings Bryan's book, The First Battle, you'll see, I think it's on page 182 and 183, the Rothschild Agreement. What was the other guy's name? Think of it. It'll come to me. And what it you know, provides the outline of getting that $4 million back in 7 years. So along came the 7 years, and they hadn't been paid the money. But they didn't dun them. They waited for a while and then came along and said, look, you know what? We have to get a little bit. And we figured out a way you can just pay us off a little bit at a time. Now, if you look in your pocket, you've got a quarter or a dime, and it's got ridges on it. And the reason those ridges are on there is because when we used to pay the Chinese railroad laborers in gold coins, they would shave them. And they put the ridges on silver coins and gold coins so that they couldn't be shaved. So these people figured out how to shave paper money by creating a central flow where all the money came through and they just took a little tiny, tiny, tiny bit, but forever. And no one ever thought about that. That's the Federal Reserve Bank. And that would not have happened if it hadn't been for the great liberator, the great fraud, Abraham Lincoln.
Wow. Pat, do you believe that, if a state were to pass a good, sound money legislation bill that would allow for a competing sound money system, that it would assist in breaking that banking taxing vortex that really has been at the crux of all of our troubles ever since 1913?
Only if there are attorneys who are willing to bet their future on what they're doing, you know, attorneys for that state, because the feds, you know, they don't need a law. They just make up stuff that sounds good.
Sure.
You know, they just make apparent law. And, you know, they're
color
just,
of law.
Color of law. Exactly.
We've got a hand up. Is it okay if we open it up for questions?
Sure. Go ahead.
Area code 702. You have a live mic. Would you like to introduce yourself and ask your question?
Hello, this is Cliven Bundy online.
Hi, Cliven.
Well, hello, Cliven.
I've been listening to you guys talk, and I just thought it's about time I better get on and visit with you a minute. So I'm here, and, you know, I'd take any question that you want to ask, but I want to say one thing. Pat McMillan, you are probably the only man that I have known except Ed Pressley that has this thing figured out right when it comes to jurisdiction of the United States government.
Well,
and,
don't forget Wayne Hage.
Yeah, Wayne Hage has it figured out fairly good, but he... let me tell you something. This jurisdiction thing is a big thing. Are we a sovereign state? Are we a territory? And that's the question. Does the United States own this land, or does the state of Nevada own this land? That's the question that's before us. And very few people understand that if the United States owns this land, then I guess they have a constitution, jurisdiction, authority, if that could possibly be, and they have unlimited power. They can rule with
as a sovereign.
Yeah, but they're not a sovereign. The state of Nevada is the sovereign. They come under the Constitution, and if anybody owns this land, it has to be the state of Nevada, the people of Clark County, Nevada, and they're the sovereign, and therefore. Excellent. Therefore, when we talk about federal courts, you've heard this and say, well, Bundy don't believe in the United States, or Bundy don't believe in the United States courts. Bundy does not believe that the United States, let's put it this way, the United States District Court of Nevada has jurisdiction and authority over my ranch.
Well, there's another thing I left out, and that is in order for the federal government to get any jurisdiction, they don't have rights, and that's a big thing. People keep talking about government rights. Governments don't have rights. They have responsibilities, and those responsibilities can give them jurisdiction, but they have to have the responsibility to get the jurisdiction. And if they have a spot in the state where they take it for a fort, dockyard, arsenal, magazine, or other needful building, before they can do that, they must file that with the governor, and the governor must approve it. And there's not one single governor of any state that has ever approved the feds coming in and taking land for a purpose that they didn't want them to have.
Well, the Constitution lays out what purpose they can have. You put that forward really fairly, you know, good. But let me tell you something. When they're talking about public land and like 90% of Nevada and you know, over 50% of the western United States, they do not have jurisdiction authority. They do not own that land.
They don't.
So therefore, their courts do not have no jurisdiction authority either.
By their claim under Category 4, they are proving by their claim they don't own the land.
That's true, but they are one thing that ties the rancher and a lot of people to it, a lot of, you know, even miners and all of the... You know what ties the rancher to the federal government? and makes their court have jurisdiction over this issue is their lease, their contract, their license, their grazing permit, however you want to put it. You know, when a rancher signs that, he's signing over his signing that the United States has unlimited power over
yeah.
his ranch, that to be a manager of his ranch. And when those ranchers do that, they are tied to the United States courts.
Did
then.
We lose somebody?
They are. Are you still there, Cliven?
Yes, I'm here.
Yeah. I want to tell you something about your little deal last month that you might not know. A friend of mine was swimming at a pool, and he got to talking with another fellow that was swimming there, and he was a highway patrol agent, a Nevada highway patrol agent. And he started telling my friend the whole story of how the highway patrol came up there, that there were four different retired highway patrol officials that were called in just to deal with this issue because Brian Sandoval said, wait a minute, those are our people there. Those aren't the federal people. What's going on? This is our state. This is not the federal state. And so he called in these guys and sent them out there, and they're the ones that talked to you before they went over to tell the feds that they were there to escort them out. And I want to tell you what this highway patrolman told me, that the first response they got after they said, we're here to escort you guys home. And the response was, thank God.
Well, let me tell you something. That story is a little twisted around. Let me tell you how I see it. Let's talk about who escorted who out there. Nobody escorted those people out of there. We, the people, drove those people out of there. And we had guns sticking down our throat when they did that. And nobody escorted anybody out. They got them out. And let me tell you something else. Are you still there?
Yeah.
Let me tell you something. If I'm going to be mad at somebody over this issue, I'm going to have to be mad over the governor of the state of Nevada. And I'm going to have to be mad over the county sheriff of Clark County.
Yeah,
now,
definitely
let me tell
the
you
sheriff.
Something. When Highway Patrol pulled up there with their sort of a swap, did they put their back towards the we the people and protect we the people? No, they did not put their back against the people and protect we the people. They put their back against the slug army of the United States BLM and Park Service, and they protected the Park Service and the BLM slugs against we the people. And you can't overlook that. Which way did they point their guns? They pointed them towards the people, not towards the enemy of the people.
Exactly.
And, you know, there's some accountability got to be put forth here, and those things are going to have to be made straight.
Yeah. When I was driving up there that day, I got caught in that traffic because of that lane closure. And I was there when they started coming back. And I counted the amount of vehicles that came back from there with the BLM thing on it, all the forerunners and the buildings and everything else. There were 100. I quit counting at 150. I don't know of anybody that's ever had that big of a federal army come after a citizen. You holding a record there. The most they ever had send out for me was 25 vehicles. There's, you know, four in each guy, in each one. But you had 150. Do you realize how much money those vehicles cost? I would say each one of those vehicles probably averaged $50,000 or $60,000. And all
well,
the
you
quad
know what
runners.
The disaster was here is, you know, we the people mandated our county sheriff to take those weapons away from those people. I said disarm them. Well, you know, if our county sheriff had disarmed them, we wouldn't have had those guns, those high-powered military guns sticking down we the people's throat.
Yeah.
But that's exactly what we the people went up against. And then what happened is they allowed these BLM thugs to leave their compound there with their weapons, escorted them onto the freeway, sent them up a high... Highway I-15 towards Arizona and Utah, and did not take their guns away, did not trace where they went, did not question what their motives might be next, and the media never even followed and found out where they went.
No.
They went into several jurisdictions. They went into the city of Mesquite. Mesquite police didn't question them. They went into Arizona, state of Arizona. They never questioned them. They went through the port of entry into Utah, and they never questioned them. And they disappeared into the counties of Utah where all of the sheriffs said that they was basically going to support Bundy. Well, if they're going to support Bundy, aren't they going to support the rest of the United States and find out where all of this armed army's going?
Yeah, and it would be really easy. I remember 20 years ago I interviewed a sheriff from Lyons County. I can't remember what state it was in. And the feds had come in and ordered the county recorder to give them personal information about citizens. And she called the sheriff, and he came over and ran them out. And he said, if you ever cross my state line again without written permission from me, I'm putting you in jail, and you're going to stay there. And they never did, as long as he was sheriff. So, you know, all someone's got to do who's an honest sheriff is just stand up and say, we're going to have law here, and you guys are out. And they will not come back against that. They won't argue against that because they have no argument. And they know a state with money who's taken up that argument will spend the money to prove it, and it's easily proved. There's a lot more stuff than what I've given here, but, you know, these are highlights that an individual can give.
You know, when I speak, I said talking about the sheriff has a constitutional jurisdiction and authority. He has policing power. He has arresting power, and he's paid by we, the people, to protect our life, liberty, and property. Now, you know, in my studies and knowledge, I have never seen the United States government or any other government ever go against a sheriff that said no.
Cliven,
nope.
Could you possibly give us an update on where you're at and what's going on right now, if you're starting a lawsuit? I had read from one of the emails that you sent out that you were looking at forming a legal group or advisory panel. Can you please update us, tell us kind of where you're at this point?
Before you do that, let me just tell you, Cliven, when I was up there, I missed you. I left it dark because I thought it was over. But I gave a video to Russ. Did you see that video that I gave him?
I've seen it. I might have it in my possession. I have not seen it. I haven't had time to hardly look at any of those things, but I hope
There's some good information on there. There's also that video that they did on Channel 3, six nights in a week, showing them disarming me. And the reason I say that is because many people have asked me, how do you stand up against those people? And there is a way to do it, but it's pretty bizarre. And, you know, I'm, for one, not willing to do it. But we can talk about that later if you want.
Yeah, but, you know, in my way of thinking, the best way to stand up against them is say no and don't negotiate.
Exactly.
And they have no jurisdiction and authority, and they, of course, they want to push us around, but we can't allow them to push us around anymore. What we want to do is have our states and our counties act like they're sovereign and act like they have some power, and the feds don't have it, so they need to act like they do have it.
Yeah.
And, you know, we can't be having sheriffs that write MOUs, memorandums of understanding. We can't have governors. We can't have Department of Agriculture dealing with these people. And, of course, the mandate of we the people is take the arms away, and that would help strengthen and weaken them a lot.
Yeah, but what weakens us, Cliven, is we want to do it by law, and they don't care about law. They fight using the appearance of law.
That's true. There's no law in this situation. It's either the law is the supreme law of the land is the Constitution of the United States, and you can go through there in 5 minutes and find out that they have no they can't own this type of property. And they have no jurisdiction over this kind of issue. So why are we worrying about them? Why don't we just sort of ignore them and go on with life and start, we the people, start acting like we're sovereigns and create strong county governments and strong county sheriffs? And let's go on with life.
Well, the problem is like...
We've got less than 1 minute left, so Pat, please give us your closing comments. Thank you all for being here tonight.
Thank you.
Pray, 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 and pray, because that's really all we got left.
I
We're not
going to
do it with law.
I want to back that up. You know, the things that happened on Bundy Ranch was very spiritual, and I want to testify that the good Lord was with us.
The only chance we have, if there is a chance, is that public opinion begins to realize that the government doesn't have rights. It has responsibilities that are enumerated, and when there's nothing enumerated, they have no business there. But, you know, it's always plausible, well, people shouldn't get free grazing land. They should pay somebody. I mean, that's just logical, right?
We're out of time, sports fans. Thank you so much. Linda, thank you very much. Pat, good night, Red. Good night, Cliven. And we got to get you guys back on here.
Good night, everybody.
Good night,
America.
Thank you.
Hello?
Yes. We still have live mics.
Okay. Did you want to say anything before I hang up, or?
I will contact you, and I'll send you those addresses for the water.
All right, good.
Take care.
Bye-bye.
Good night.
Faithful God, ever true, you are the one that we lean upon. Faithful God, Lord, it's you. You are the one that we lean upon.